Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
And I forgot that I would have to do it again.
And we're without a Chris again. He only shows up for the glamour episodes like Warriors.
I suppose, yeah.
Well, I finally got around to watching that Age of Ultron trailer, or the third trailer that's been released.
Right. What were the other two? Just kind of like short 30
seconds. One
second
and two.
Things?
Sorry.
Okay. I did ask for that. Okay. Because the third trailer was about like 2.5 minutes long, something like that?
I think they were all about the same length.
Okay.
Yeah, they're on YouTube. I would say the first two trailers actually made really good use of music, especially the second one. Like the music that they chose, it was a bit atmospheric, a little bit creepy.
Okay.
And it matched the Pinocchio theme of Ultron.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I've only seen the third one because, it's kind of big news on social media. I saw it going around and I figured, okay, you know what? I'll just bite the bullet early and go watch it rather than, you know, the Star Wars trailer, which I actually still haven't seen.
Oh, that's weird. Not really sure what to say. James Spader sounds like he's going to do a good job as Ultron after watching three trailers. I wonder if I've seen all the best parts.
Right, right.
The third trailer is probably my least favorite in that it seemed very typical.
That's the only one I've watched, and that's what I was wondering where I, you know, as I think you said, sometimes you watch movie trailers and you think to yourself, did I watch everything exciting already? And, I don't know. I'm wondering if that's the case with this third trailer. Also, I'm wondering if Avengers Age of Ultron is just going to be more of the same of what we got in Avengers. And based on the trailer, that's kind of what it looks like, where I'm not all that excited. But
what's going to have Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver? The second movie, Quicksilver. Because
okay.
There was one in X-Men Days of Future Past.
Right.
The Avengers movies are well-made movies. I'm just wondering if we're rewarding movies for just being well-made. And, of course, having characters that we're familiar with, as opposed to giving you surprises. Being original?
I am going to be cynical and say that we reward movies for making money.
Yeah, or being familiar.
Yes.
And unlike X-Men Days of Future Past, and I guess I'm not saying that that's an incredibly original movie, but in the battles, I really felt like there were stakes involved.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just a bunch of characters quipping and cracking wise. In trailer 3, you got that. You actually don't, in the first two trailers, you don't see them making a lot of wisecracks.
Okay, maybe I'll go back and watch those then.
Yeah, the second one, it's kind of mysterious, and then the third one kind of just tells you everything.
Right.
Oh, I see, so he made Ultron to do this, and now his solution is this, and that's going to mean fighting a lot of Ultrons.
Right.
And apparently that Hulkbuster Hulk battle is going to be epic, i.e. will go on a long time.
Yeah, well, you said epic, and like, aren't all the battles in that going to be quote-unquote epic, where you're like, wow, okay, you know, massive destruction where, you know, Hulk and the Hulkbuster suit are fighting, and then I'm just going to be massive destruction in that big all-out battle between the Avengers and all those, you know, Ultron suits. And I don't know, it's going to sound, you know, cynical, but it doesn't excite me because everything is big, so therefore, nothing is big and exciting. And watching trailer 3, I'm wondering if I'm going to have that moment somewhere in the middle of this final battle, like I did with the first Avengers movie, and I'm going to think to myself, this fight is still going on. Can it please just end? Because I'm tired of it.
Yeah. And again, in contrast to X-Men Days of Future Past, that in that movie, they did tricks. So, I mean, they have powers. And then when you watch the movie, you watch the different characters use their powers in a creative way. Now, I guess if you've got Thor, who's got the hammer, and Hulk, who's just super strong. I mean, actually, the comics have them do pretty clever things with their abilities, but the movies don't seem to do that.
Well, I was wondering, because you started to bring that up, and from what you've told me about, like, you know, Hulk and Thor, you've said, like, Hulk before can, like, you know, clap his hands, and because he's so strong, it just makes a shockwave, or, you know, Thor can fly with that hammer, or, you know, do all kinds of other things, and, yeah, maybe they're saving it for the movie, but I don't know. Yeah, it just kind of seems like people bashing into each other and causing a lot of destruction. Yeah.
But I will still see it.
And
whether
see it.
Whether I see it in the theater or watch it on DVD. Probably DVD.
Well, in that case, you'll have to wait a lot longer, or maybe not at all. Because remember, the original Avengers opened pretty much worldwide. Like, we got it at the same time as the States. And this time, like, it's coming out May 1st? The May 1st or May 5th in the States, I think.
First or 5th. Oh, May.
Yeah. Early May. Early May. We don't get it in Japan until July 4th.
Oh, okay.
Which I was surprised about at first.
USA. Oh, perfect. My 4th of July plans, which I never have.
Yep. Yeah. It's so important here, yeah.
Yeah, and also I'm not American. So.
Right. As soon as I said that, I'm like, and also I was Canadian, right. Double whammy.
Well, in gaming news, or personal news, I got the second Torg bundle of holding.
More Torg.
I guess I should just say the second Torg bundle from a bundle of holding.
You said that looked pretty good, like it was stuff that you didn't already have.
There was some overlap between the two bundles, but only two titles overlap. And I believe I actually have all of those books in book form, but I didn't have them as PDF.
Right.
So I'm pretty happy with that. Yeah.
We also got the Hillfolk bundle.
Yes, we
did. The Drama System bundle.
Yeah.
And each of us, well, you're farther along than me, but you're still only about 10 pages into it.
Yeah, wading through that. Yeah. So Hillfolk, it certainly sounds interesting. I think the pitch is, as opposed to, I mean, if you look at like the relationships and the dramatics versus kind of the procedural aspects of a TV show,
okay,
they're focusing on the relationships and the drama,
hmm.
Whereas the average role-playing game or the typical role-playing game focuses more on the procedural stuff or the more adventure stuff because mm-hmm. they're based on adventure stories, whereas these will be based more on kind of like the modern TV show that you watch. So, for example, if you watched, just because I'm watching it now, it's fresh in my mind, Justified,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to solving those little crimes, it's maybe about the dynamics within the marshal office.
Okay.
And the problems there, the relationship with the boss, the relationship with the colleague.
Right, so the job is background.
Yeah, and that's the pitch. And just getting into it, I mean, they talk about the relationship that, and that's part of the character process, like hardwired. And I mean, we've talked about doing that anyway in your game, regardless of it, if it's in the rules.
Oh, kind of like a group character creation thing?
Yeah, it always works if two players say, hey, our characters know each other because of X.
Right.
And develop that relationship before the game starts so that the game can start without everybody meets in the bar and
yeah. decides to adventure for
yeah,
some
and
reason.
You now form a bond in 5 minutes.
Right.
But they hardwired into the system, and it reminded me of Powered by the Apocalypse games, and it reminded you of Fate.
Okay, yeah.
Some of the pitches would be worlds, or settings.
Right.
Settings would be a better word. But in Hillfolk, they call them pitches. Some of the pitches were quite intriguing. So there was like one about Norse gods on their twilight, Norse gods in space and on in their twilight. One about like drug cartel.
Oh, that does sound pretty
something
cool.
Like something about thieves within a city, fantasy thieves within a city. Another one about economics and free market or capitalism and free market in the fantasy world.
Oh, okay. Because until you added in the fantasy world, I'm like, okay, what about economics? I'm not seeing where that's going.
Well, one of them, I guess we'll give it an A for originality, is about a college paper, a university newspaper.
Okay.
So that's really interesting. And each pitch is about 7 pages.
Hmm. Yeah, I haven't read them yet, but the idea sounds like Fiasco playsets, where it's kind of like, you know, Fiasco playsets are all these elements you pick from to kind of build, not your setting, but kind of the relationship between the characters and goals and motivations and things that get used in the scene. And yeah, I still have to see what the pitch looks like, but
mm-hmm.
that's kind of what this sounds like, or similar to, yeah.
Yeah. It has, I'm going to say, a high player minimum, where they say like about 5 to 8.
Mm.
And I think, you know, I think people might think that's typical. But I think for a lot of play groups, that kind of minimum means that I hope it's pretty Skype or Google Hangouts friendly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so people who are in smaller gaming communities can find the players to run or participate in one of these games.
Right.
Yeah, because I play a Rifts game weekly, and we have a lot of players, but we do it on Skype, and we are across 3 countries, Canada, America, and Japan.
Right. Yeah, I'm interested about a lot of things about Hillfolk, and yeah, see where it goes.
Oh, yeah, we should say that the default setting is fantasy, and they kind of say, imagine you're like a raiding party, or a raiding party chief and his or her inner circle.
Mm-hmm.
So, not the, hence Hillfolk.
Right.
Well, speaking of Rifts, in my playgroup, people play different games. They play Star Wars, Dungeons & Dragons, you're familiar with that, as well as the Palladium system, but at least one player, and I've known this person since high school, has been pretty loyal to Palladium. They do branch out into other games such as Star Wars, but their primary game has been Rifts and other Palladium games like Heroes Unlimited,
okay,
or Ninjas and Super Spies, Robotech. And that's in contrast, I was thinking in contrast to myself or in contrast to Wayne or Chris, is where we try a bunch of different games. And it just got me thinking about, I mean, the two main styles. And of course there's like Facebook groups where people talk, and when they talk, you get a sense from some people that they clearly only play Dungeons and Dragons. Or right. they may have dabbled in other games, but they'll always return, and the primary game is always Dungeons and Dragons. And there's certainly nothing wrong with that, but it got me thinking, what would that be like? You know, I started, you know, of course I started with Dungeons and Dragons. I played Palladium quite early on, but what if I thought, you know, this is all I need, and just stuck to one system?
Yeah, I don't know. That's kind of hard for me to imagine, because as you said, I think all three of us are, like, we enjoy trying out new systems, and yeah, I literally can't imagine what it would be like to pick one and then stick to kind of only one system, because I felt it did everything I needed it to do. I mean, there are systems that I like, you know, like Apocalypse World, you know, Cortex Plus, a bunch of other ones, but none of them do everything that I like, mm-hmm. So I can't imagine just kind of picking one and only doing that.
Yeah. All right, well, way to be objective, because this is, in this episode, what we're going to look at is those two basic styles of game mastering or playing role-playing games, and that is to be a generalist, to play a bunch of different games, or to be a specialist, and that means to stick to one game and really, really learn it inside out.
And I will try to be objective.
So what we've done is we've broken them down into a couple categories, and what we'll do is evaluate the two approaches. Of course, whatever approach works for you. But we thought it would be interesting just to discuss what you could get out of doing one over the other. And of course, we've kind of tipped our own experiences that we are dilettantes. You know, we play a lot of different games. We dabble. But we are going to try to imagine what it would be like if we had only specialized.
I'm going to try very, very hard.
Yeah.
No promises.
Okay. So when we talk about each category, we're going to kind of see which approach kind of wins out in each category. And at the end of the episode, we'll see which one is the best approach, just based on our completely arbitrary system.
The first.
All right, and the first category is probably the first category that you would think of when you are comparing these two approaches, and that is rules.
Yeah, it's just kind of the easiest one to go with first. So, obviously, if you are a specialist, then one of the benefits, you know, of sticking to that one game system is you will eventually learn the rules inside and out. And I can definitely see the appeal of that because, you know, if you're running a new game, you're kind of nervous, you don't know the rules that well, and, you know, if you keep jumping around from system to system to system, you're never really going to learn any one system all that well. And I think as a game master, being comfortable with the system you're running is one of the, I guess, steps into being a good game master, because you're not worried about remembering the rules or, you know, remembering any bonuses or mechanics or stuff like that. You can kind of focus on getting the players into the story, can, you know, running the story as opposed to running the game. And so, yeah, despite my liking to be a generalist, I can totally see why sticking to one system is appealing to some people.
No, absolutely. I mean, just playing games you find where I'm running a game or I'm in a game that somebody else is running, and there can sometimes be confusion of rules, especially if they're similar type of systems.
Mm.
And you make a rules call, or you try to do something that actually comes from another game. And this actually happened in my last session of Rift.
Oh, really?
And I find when you play a lot of different games and you're not that familiar with the system, then a lot of times you're making calls,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, oh, you wing it, which is fine. And of course, most role-playing books will say on the first page or the second page, the number one rule is to have fun and don't let rules interfere
right. With
having fun. But it's also nice that you're doing that because you're trying to have fun and not because you don't know the rule.
Right, right.
And that becomes really obvious when you're winging it, because you know something, this situation, you know, demands that we wing it because this is going to be best for the story, as opposed to, I don't know the rules, so we'll wing it.
No, that's exactly what I was gonna say, and I was trying to think of a word to explain the difference between, yeah, winging it because you don't know how things should be handled properly, and winging it because you are so comfortable with the system that, you know just kind of what you can ignore and what you can't. And yeah, again, you kind of brought this up. Well, I mean, the golden rule is ignore everything in favor of story, but I think you can go too far with that if you're running the game, because then it's just like, why are we even playing the system at all? Why don't we just kind of do what we did when we were kids and have a completely narrative game, which could be awesome, but we're no longer playing the system.
Yeah, I mean, if you sit down and you're playing a game with a 400-page rule book, and you're going through the game essentially doing paper, rock, scissors because the game master or a lot of the players don't really know the rules, then that can be frustrating. I mean, if you're playing a game with a 20-page rule book and it's pretty much just, hey, do this story.
Right.
You know, tell a story together, then, yeah, I mean, that's what you're supposed to do. But, yeah, so there's definitely advantages there. And when you have a specialist, especially if the specialist is the game master, but there's also some value with having a specialist as at least one of the players.
Right, okay.
In that the games will run a lot more smoothly.
Mm.
And we were talking prior to the episode about, of course, rules lawyers are bad. It has a negative connotation. But if you can have like a rules manager or a rules mentor.
Okay.
Or, sorry, what were you saying?
I said rules encyclopedia.
A rules encyclopedia, yeah. Somebody like that who can be, in our little play group, Yujiro is one of those type of players.
Mm.
And we have, again, the person I know from high school, because he's pretty much devoted himself to Palladium, then he's able to recall a lot of rules, which will help the game master. And in those two examples, they're players that I would describe as, yeah, like a rules manager or rules mentor. They actually help the game master run the game more smoothly because they learn the rules inside out.
Right. Not to get into it, but I think the difference between a rules lawyer and a rules mentor is the rules lawyer will stop the game to correct a rule even when you really no one asked or you really should just keep going, while a rules mentor, I think, usually waits until someone asks for advice.
Well, sometimes they can be proactive and chime in when they think it will help the game.
Okay.
But yeah, I think the major difference is a rules lawyer is a and the rules manager isn't. So.
Right. No, that's a much shorter way to put it, yeah.
So, yeah, rules lawyers are like pornography, you know. Maybe you can't describe them, but when they're sitting next to you, okay, you know them.
Okay. I was really wondering where that was going. I'm like, I came up with everything else except that.
Yeah.
Well, we didn't discuss this before, but what do you think about, I guess there's kind of a hybrid, not necessarily a hybrid approach, but I'm thinking things like Cortex Plus with its dramatic, heroic, and action role-playing, which are very similar, mm-hmm. but have minor differences, or like Powered by the Apocalypse, where again, there are elements that are very similar, but there are still differences. Would you consider them, I guess, kind of different systems, or were we talking kind of like that's a system family and kind of counted as one group?
Yeah, I guess it's a family, whereas something like Palladium, of course, Rifts, mm-hmm. they actually use the same system, and the differences in rules between the settings is pretty minor.
Okay.
Although enough that you should familiarize yourself with each setting, whereas a family, and I like that term, would be like the Cortex family, where they are actually three different systems, although very, very similar. So in that case, I can, you probably almost be a specialist, but I can see somebody then confusing themselves because they're running it one way. And I think when you started running Leverage,
right,
because Marvel Heroic Roleplaying is what introduced us to the family. And there was a couple of times when we were like, we were recalling stuff, but we weren't sure if we were recalling it from Marvel or the Heroic system, or we were using the Leverage system.
Right. No, that's almost a little bit more confusing because the systems in that family are so similar that, yeah, that's exactly right. You can't remember where you remembered this rule from, and maybe it's from one of these variations of the game. But I suppose maybe you could consider like D20 a family of systems too.
Yeah, but I mean, if we had only focused on that, then I think then you become a specialist where it does become a happy compromise, I guess, where you have a broader range of systems, but they're so close that you were able to specialize in all three, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I think, actually, I thought when you talked about the hybrid approach, I thought you were going to refer to us because even though we do dabble in systems, we tend to run certain systems a little bit more than others. Like I think I run more World of Darkness than other systems, whereas you've run
I guess more powered by the Apocalypse stuff.
Yeah, more powered by the Apocalypse. Chris has been more interested in, like, Fate than us, or at least he got started and always keeps revisiting Fate and trying to think of different things to run with that system.
So essentially what we have are three quasi-specialists?
No, Dabbler.
Okay. Fair enough. I was trying to make it sound a little bit better. Okay, so we have three Dabblers with their own little areas of... What? Not expertise. Interest?
Yeah, I suppose.
And then the other people are just like, okay, yeah, sure, I'll play whatever.
Yeah. All right, so I think I'd have to give the edge when we talk about rules to the specialist.
Yeah, talking about time. It takes less time to get really familiar or really good with one system than it does with multiples.
So. Yeah, and it can be quite impressive. I mean, when you watch conversations and people seek advice, I mean, if they seek just general gaming advice, everybody can chime in, but sometimes they talk about rules. And I recently played X-Wing against a guy who has play tested some things for the for Fantasy Flight. For example, Rebel Aces, he provided feedback on a lot of that, and that was a pretty good set. And talking to him, it's very interesting because you can just ask him a lot of rules questions or build questions, and he's able to give you an answer immediately because that's his favorite game, and he's really focused on that game. And that's pretty impressive. I mean, he's a good resource, even though that's not a role-playing game. But.
No, but I mean, it's still kind of the same thing, yeah.
Yeah, so definitely an edge for the specialist. And the next category we had is money.
Because we're all adults with differing levels of disposable income, and yeah, buying these books is expensive. So I guess that's one of the big cons for being a generalist, is that you're interested in all these different systems, and you end up spending a lot of money because, hey, there's another cool system you want to try out.
Yeah, because, I mean, you buy the core book, and I do have certain things that stopped at the core book, like Cthulhu Tech. I had the core book, and I actually like the game, but yeah, it's just tough to keep building different libraries.
Yeah. Bundle of Holding is making it easier because they're usually pretty decent deals, but still, it is more money, so.
Yeah, it's just crazy how many I've bought recently. Oh, well. Crazy like a fox.
Right. Yeah, trying to think of something to put in there, yeah. I think the winner here is Specialist, right? Because you are... It's just, well, I don't want to say less to buy because there's a big but there. I'm thinking of like Dungeons & Dragons 3.5 where, holy crap, how many books do they put out for that thing? Or like, I'm sure there are other games where they just put out a lot of supplementary material where maybe you aren't spending less money, but at least that one you kind of know what you are looking for.
No, that's a good point. I mean, if you... Like, if your chosen system happens to be a game, like you said, Dungeons & Dragons, which does have a pretty extensive library, then you could spend as much as a dabbler on books. But I think it gets into the personality. People are collectors or they aren't. Like, I'm a collector, whereas Chris isn't.
Right,
so
okay.
Chris will buy, like, the core book for Savage Worlds and then stop buying stuff, even though he's interested in that game, and he'll run the game using that. Whereas I will buy, you know, the core book and then maybe a supplement I like and then keep adding. So I would be a completist regardless of whether I was a dabbler or a specialist. And with a specialist, I guess there's kind of an end in sight.
Okay.
Whereas a dabbler, there is no end because there's always one more system to buy and all the subsequent books for that, you know.
Right. So. No, I guess I'm kind of similar where... Yeah, there are types of games that I like. I guess maybe not specific lines or families or groups or anything like that, but there are types of games that I like or am interested in, and there are types of games that I tend to think I probably wouldn't be interested in. Like if something skews more towards like D20 or something like that, I'm probably not going to be interested in and don't look at it. But I am kind of a completist where once I start to collect something and or buy into something, I tend to want it all. So... I guess it's good that I kind of know what I like or what I don't. Otherwise, I'd be spending a lot of money.
Yeah. Not really much more to say on that, eh?
Right.
Yeah. So I guess edge again to specialist.
Oh, we're just shooting ourselves in the foot here, aren't we?
Yeah, so I guess we've made some bad choices in our past.
Right. You said I wouldn't be objective. So the next category is ideas.
Yeah, and I think we're both the same in that you draw ideas from... different games and use them. And we mentioned the drawback of that when we talked about the rules and that you can confuse the rules.
Right.
But drawing different ideas from different games, though, like how to, you know, what kind of story to tell or how to tell the story, I mean, makes for a more effective session or campaign. So
I think you're exactly right. So after seeing how like Fate does chases or other systems do other things, you can say, I like how, you know, one system does this over what another system does, and that allows you to pull out ideas from the different systems and not mash them together in a Frankenstein's monster, but I mean, you can use what you like from certain systems to inform your decision of how you handle things in other systems. And that's a lot of systems, but I can't think of a better way to say it.
No, absolutely. And I might be just restating what you've already said, but it also encourages you to play a different way or incorporate different styles. So you're talking about like different approaches to something like doing a chase.
Mm.
But also if you play like a World of Darkness game or when we if we play Hill Folk and we find, I really like the emphasis on relationships and the dramatics of the story as opposed to solving problems and doing an adventure.
Right.
But then you incorporate that play style to the game. Not necessarily the rules, but the play style. And like we said, I mean, we do play some games such as Fate or Powered by the Apocalypse, which kind of hardwires character relationships into the system.
Mm.
But we also do that for games that don't have that.
No, that's a
because
good point.
We played some games that do it and we think, wow, that really made it a lot easier to get started.
Right, right.
So by dabbling or being a generalist, you just have a bigger pool to draw from.
Right.
That reminds me of our review of Numenera. And the game or Monty Cook touted the game as being innovative.
Right.
And something that he wanted to do for about 20 years. And just innovations that he would want to include into role-playing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of you guys had said, yeah, it would be innovative if somebody had only played Dungeons & Dragons, or if somebody had ignored the last 20 or 30 years of role-playing games.
Oh, right, right.
And picked up Numenera and opened it and went, wow, what a leap.
Mm.
And miss all of the steps in between Dungeons & Dragons and Numenera.
Which aren't that many, but yeah.
And then took a bunch of steps back, you know.
Ouch, I thought I was being harsh.
For a dabbler, then you see all those steps, and you see the directions games go. Some of them are noble failures. I mean, they go in a direction, they burn out, but you can still get ideas from that approach.
Right, I was going to say those games were kind of like dead ends, because, you know, they explore something, and then, I tend to think that anything that goes to print, or maybe not in this age of self-publication, you know, generally works. It just might not catch on, or it might not be all that good with what was self-publishing, you know. But, yeah, being a dabbler, you can kind of stay abreast of what's going on in the role-playing game sphere, if you will, and you get to see kind of what those latest innovations are. And, I mean, even if you're not getting them at the time when they are, quote-unquote, new for everybody else, you still do eventually see them. Whereas if you are a specialist and kind of only focus on one game, well, then you're probably going to miss them. Or, you know, maybe not get like a watered-down version, but I'm thinking of, Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition, which just came out. Well, they have the inspiration mechanic, which, in my opinion, seems very similar to a style, you know, chip, a fate point, or even a Benny from Savage Worlds. And, yeah, fair enough, if you had only played Dungeons & Dragons, you might go, wow, that's awesome, that's great. But if you've played other things, you know, from being a generalist, you're like, I've kind of seen this before.
No, absolutely. And, you know, you saying that makes me think that a specialist relies on the game designers to introduce fresh ideas into their game in a lot of respects. I mean, certainly a specialist can come up with those ideas on their own.
Right.
And incorporate them. And because like we said earlier in the episode, they know the rules inside out. They're going to have the confidence to adjust the game and make house rules and that.
Yes, yes.
But, yeah, they're drawing from a shallower pool.
Mm.
So when the designers of 5e introduce something like the inspiration, yeah, that just seems like an innovative idea to somebody who's drawing from that shallow pool.
Right, and that's not, you sound like we're kind of being negative, but I want to say, like, that's not really negative, because no matter how long something has been out, everything has the potential to be new to someone, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not to say you have to be at the cutting edge, quote-unquote, of, you know, role-playing games, and it's fine that you specialists kind of get to those things when the designer puts them out. So
yeah, and I should say, I'm not saying that the generalist is more creative than the specialist. They're not coming up with these ideas on their own. They're just taking them from one area and moving them to another.
Right.
So they have more to borrow. They have a bigger library to borrow from.
it might actually be more difficult to be creative when you're a generalist because you're seeing all these things and you're going, oh man, I had something similar, so never mind.
That's a good point, yeah. And I bet you a lot of people that do come up with those house rules, a lot of them play Dungeons and Dragons, are people that only play that system. So what they do is if they encounter a problem with that system, they'll go, well, now I'll try to house rule it. But they're not porting in something from another game because they've had to create it on their own.
Right.
But with all that said, I think we'd have to give the edge to the generalist.
Finally.
The pool is wider and deeper. The library has more shelves and more books on them.
Right. That pool also smells a lot less like D&D.
Yeah. The bank has more money and other analogies.
Okay. You said bank and I thought like edge of a body of water. And then you said money and I'm like... Don't do the connection. Oh,
there are more bodies on this bank.
Something. So the next area is versatility. And again, I think Lyle and Chris and myself are all kind of similar, where we tend to think that certain systems are better or worse for certain types of genres or certain types of stories just because of how the mechanics handle themselves or what they let you do. And here is another category where I think the advantage goes to being a generalist, because if you have all these games you kind of dabble in or all these systems you know fairly well, then you have a broader group to choose from when you are, you know, picking a system to play a certain type of game in. You know, if you only stick to that one system for being a specialist, well, I tend to think that one thing or one system can't do everything, or at least can't do everything well. Whereas, you know, if you're a generalist, you could pick that system specifically designed to play whatever story or genre you intend to play.
Yeah, sometimes you'll see online where people ask, oh, how do I make or how do I play this style of game using, again, Dungeons and Dragons? And I look at that, my first reaction is, well, don't use that system.
Right. So depending on how snarky I'm feeling, sometimes I reply with that, where it's like...
How do I do science fiction with Dungeons & Dragons? Is there anything other than Spelljammer I can draw from, and you're just...
Hey, Spelljammer is actually pretty cool.
No. Hey, I'm not begging Spelljammer, yeah. But you're kind of thinking, well, there are actually science fiction games that you could use for science fiction.
Like, I'm drawing a blank on an example, but I've seen a lot of those, and I've also seen a lot of the...
What's the best build for a Jedi?
Right. That was exactly what I was going to say. How do I play character type X in system Y? And a lot of times, my knee-jerk reaction is, well, you don't, because it's not that type of game, you know? But, I mean, if you are a specialist, and if you do know the rules inside and out, well, then maybe you can house rule the game to play in whatever type of genre or to tell whatever type of story you want to play. But I think there comes a certain point where the amount of effort you have put in into adapting that system to play a specific setting or story reaches, you know, a point where it would have been easier to just switch systems.
Yeah, and learn that new system.
Right.
Yeah, and in the adaptation, they can actually do one of the main advantages that, you know, specialists have is that they know the rules inside out, and if everybody at the table are specialists, then everybody is very, very familiar with the rules. But then when you start tacking on these house rules to accommodate a genre that the rules weren't really meant to play, then people start forgetting what the rules are. Or what the rules are for this particular game. And I've played house rule D&D systems, and it does become confusing because you're getting like scraps of paper with additional rules. And you know, if you misplace that, then you can't just turn to the main rule book to make your character or make a new character or to level up, because you've got all of these other rules bolted onto it.
Right. Now, I was a specific example I was thinking of, like after we had finished playing Hollow Earth Expedition and then had started playing Vampire, I remember Chris said that one of the reasons he didn't like Vampire, but one of the things he had trouble adjusting to was the dice pool, because success was much less likely on any individual die in New World of Darkness than it was in Ubiquity. And I remember saying, like, well, that's because Ubiquity is supposed to be this kind of over-the-top pulp action genre where heroes are meant to be larger than life, whereas New World of Darkness is supposed to be darker and grittier and success much less frequent.
Yeah, but he wanted to play Vampire like Grand Theft Auto.
Well, he did want to play Vampire like Grand Theft Auto. Yeah, I remember.
Yes.
So perhaps we should have switched systems. And see, being generalists, I guess we could have switched systems. But my point there was... Okay, you could change it so that the dice mechanics in New World of Darkness were more like Ubiquity. And that's a fairly easy fix, but instead of doing that, why not just play Ubiquity? It's a different type of game, and the system is already set up to kind of do what you want it to do.
Yeah, one thing to be careful of is when you make a change, and changing like the something with the dice pool is a pretty dramatic change for a game like Hollow Earth Expedition or World of Darkness. You might not anticipate how that would disrupt the balance that the designers have put into the game.
Hmm. Like, I know some people I've talked to, they don't like that word balance, and I can kind of see their point. I would tend to think that the designers had an intent in mind when they put the system together.
Okay. Yeah, I'll go with that word if it makes people happier.
Whatever. Yeah. I mean, I'm just saying, I can see people arguing about that. But yeah, and it's kind of like any tool or any system, the person who made it had an intent for how it would be used. And as long as you use it in that way, it's going to do what the designer intended it to do. When you use it for a new purpose, okay, maybe it works great, right? You can use a hammer to stir a bucket of paint. It's not going to be the best one, but it will work. But don't complain when, you know, it doesn't work as good as something designed to stir paint. That's not a great example, but it's the first one that came to mind.
Well, no, actually, it was a pretty good example. I don't think you needed to elaborate beyond. You can use a hammer to stir a bucket of paint. I think perfect.
Right.
I was like, oh, you're still talking. But, but no, I thought that was really good.
Cool.
Yeah. You know, I think intent is a really good word because you take a game like Rifts, which
has no balance.
Where the balance is laughable, but the designers clearly had an intent with what they've put in there.
Hmm, right.
So if you don't play it a certain way or if you tweak, you know, you throw more skills over to the Glitter Boy because you want him to have these skills and you got the Rogue Scientist that suddenly
has nothing.
It's not like you took the skills from the Rogue Scientist, but they're definitely a skill monkey.
Right.
Then you're taking away from their role. I mean, it's still, you know, the Glitter Boy still's got the boom gun, but you're also then now stealing some of the spotlight from the Rogue Scientist.
And they had little to begin with, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So. Yeah, maybe Rift wasn't the best example there, because I'm pretty sure the intent there was be awesome at everything.
I was just thinking about a game where they say, like, real life is not balanced.
Right.
And that's part of the intent of the designers, is that there isn't necessarily a balance. But if you start monkeying with the rules too much, even in the Palladium system, then you could be messing up the intent of the designers. So I guess we're going to have to give the edge when it comes to versatility to the generalist.
Yes, 2 for 2. Or not 2 for 2, 2 and 2 and 2.
So 2 and 2. And our last category is community. And this is something that you were talking about when you first started thinking about how to divide or how to compare these two systems.
Yeah, I mean, I guess with the, you know, with everybody being online and being on social media now, it's, you know, natural to join a community related to role-playing games, you know, based on whatever you follow. And if you are a specialist, well, then it's arguably a lot easier to join a community because you're usually only looking in one or two, maybe three places. Because, hey, because there's only kind of one place that you're going to look. Whereas, you know, if you are a generalist, I'm guessing you're going to want to, you know, keep up with kind of all your games. I know I do. And then your interests are spread out over a lot broader area. And maybe it's similar to rules where if you are a specialist, you can devote less time to engaging with the community only because there are fewer places to go. Whereas if you are a generalist, then you're going to end up spending more time engaging with the community because you belong to several.
No, that's a good point about the time. And yeah, also finding people. I mean, if you're a generalist, because you're more open to different games, then you can find not only just online, but like play groups in your town or your city, because you just need to find people that play role-playing games.
Right, right.
And then play whatever they're playing. Whereas a specialist, I mean, I guess if they're lucky and they play a game like Dungeons & Dragons, because it's so ubiquitous, that it would be easy to find a play group.
Right.
But if you're specializing in Cthulhu tech or, you know, or a game that hasn't been in print for or hasn't been around for a while, like Torg, then you might have trouble finding people to play with.
Right. Or at least have trouble finding people to play your system of choice with.
Yeah, but I guess, I suppose then if you're open to playing their their type of game. I mean, if your favorite game is Torg, but you never play Torg because you're too busy playing Dungeons and Dragons and Palladium and Shadowrun,
right.
Then I guess you can call yourself a generalist, even though in your heart you're a specialist.
Right. In your heart you're a specialist, but yeah, you effectively are a generalist. No, I gotcha.
Yeah, you know, you sit there at the table, I hate this.
Right.
It's all part of your master plan, unleash Torg on them.
Right.
Yeah, and community is really important. What was it? I think it was Ryan Dancy that said that with these games, you need a network.
Okay.
Like with role-playing games. And if you don't have the network, you really don't have a game.
That's a good point. You have a book that you are reading. No, I think you mentioned it, but yeah, you're absolutely right. If you are a generalist, that increases your chances of finding that player base to play that game because you are a bit more open and willing to play anything where, yeah, unless you've specialized in a really popular game, which actually isn't all that difficult to do, then your rule books are going to be rule books that you read and don't really play.
Yeah, but we can see people that will post things and say, I'm looking for a group that plays D&D 3.5. You know, is there anybody in the area? And they might say an area like Los Angeles. You know, well, you think you have a pretty good chance of finding somebody.
Right.
But if they're like, oh, I'm looking for a play group that plays D&D 3.0, not 3.5, thank you, in Saskatoon, and you're like, well, good luck, buddy.
Right.
But if somebody were to even say, like, expand it a bit, you know, I'm looking to play Dungeons and Dragons, or, hey, anybody play fantasy games? I like that. And, of course, hey, anybody play role-playing games?
Right. I can see the ad now. I am looking to form a group to play a, quote, role-playing game from anywhere in the world.
Yeah, I'm lonely. Every night, free.
Wow. Yeah.
I thought this was this category would be more up in the air, like the kind of split. And I suppose if you do play a game like Dungeons & Dragons, which you'll always be able to find players,
right?
Then you don't have the disadvantages that a typical specialist might have. Also, like you said, you have more time, I suppose, because you can devote it all to, you're not getting distracted by multiple systems. So you can engage in the community like really deeply and really fully during those times that you've devoted to gaming.
Like you mentioning that, maybe that's, I don't know, maybe that's one of the appeals of being a specialist is that, you know, people like to share their ideas, even though sometimes they shouldn't. And, you know, in this age of kind of instant communication, there is that gratification of being able to share your knowledge base and specializing in a game. Again, I'm going to use D&D because it's the easy example. And then being able to focus all of that time in that one place, maybe that feels more rewarding because you're kind of able to share more of this knowledge that you've spent, you know, kind of becoming an expert on this system. And I imagine that could feel pretty good. Or I imagine it's easier to kind of build up, not an online presence, but it's easier to seem kind of like very knowledgeable about that subject. Whereas, yeah, if you're dividing your time between, you know, learning different systems as a generalist and then spending whatever time you spend online between these multiple communities, maybe, not that it seems like you're less of an expert, but I imagine it would take longer to get to that point that a specialist does.
No, good point. Drawing from the very first category of rules, I mean, you're using your knowledge of the rules that's translating into status or
within the community. Exactly what I was trying to say. Yeah.
And yeah, I could see that being very attractive to someone. And you look on different forums, I mean, like a Pathfinder, you go into Paizo and you read about people talking about Pathfinder and sharing their knowledge about how to do a really good fighter build, or what would the effects of this spell be. And then, you know, people are going to respect you within that community because they can draw upon that. So yeah, I guess using that knowledge to...
No, I think you said it right. Using that knowledge and that time focus to kind of build some status for yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas a dabbler, you come in and you can talk a little bit about a game, but not too deeply. And then probably you're going to try to talk about the other games that you play, and that may or may not be welcome by that particular group that you're talking to.
Right. Good point.
So I mean, I think you'd like to talk about Powered by the Apocalypse quite a bit. And, and maybe people are talking about Savage Worlds, and they don't appreciate that.
Well, see, there's the flaw in your logic there. I would not go and frequent a Savage Worlds forum.
Hey. I played once.
Yeah. Right.
I still want to say that the generalist does have the edge in this category in that they can, it gets back into, hey, does anybody want to play a role-playing game?
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty open, and probably, you know, if they're a bit of a generalist, they might be able to pick up rules fairly quickly because they've played a bunch of different systems.
Right.
And I guess they would be pretty open to different things. So, but yeah, it's pretty split on this one.
So 2.5 to 2.5?
Oh, what a cop-out. No, I'll say give the edge to the generalist, in my opinion. I don't know if you want to...
Well, seeing as how it's our podcast, I think we're allowed to say anything we want. So I'm going to say... No, I'm going to agree. Yep, I give the edge to the generalist. Ha!
Okay, so edge to the generalist. So specialist, I'm sorry. You chose the wrong approach.
Right.
So, yeah. What about for a new gamer? What would you recommend? Do you recommend that they just play one game for a while and get a feel for role-playing with that one system and learn the rules there inside out? Or should they kind of just jump around and try to look for systems that appeal to them?
I'm going to say find a system that you like and kind of stick to it for a while, because I think, at least from a GMing perspective, one of the important things to... I guess get when you're GMing is a familiarity with the system you're running. So in that case, I think sticking to a system until you feel like you can run it pretty well kind of wins out over jumping around to experience different systems.
I'm going to agree with you, and for a slightly different reason, though, although I think you raised a good point. And mine is to try to get into a campaign.
Okay.
Because that's a more rewarding experience than a series of one-shots or mini-adventures.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then you establish that relationship with that gaming group. And maybe that gaming group does dabble and jumps around. But if they're committed to this particular campaign, stick with it. Get to know the players really well. And you can always jump off later, you know, after a few months or a year to a different system. But yeah, it's the campaigns that give you the best stories and give you the best role-playing experience. So, like, that will hook you more than, you know, just sitting down for a few hours and playing a game and then sort of knowing what you were doing and then trying something completely different the next time.
Right, right. No, I agree with that, yeah.
Or doing that, you're also playing the same character, so you have a chance to, like, really explore different things with that character and really get into the drama and the storyline and the narrative side of it. So, yeah.
If you're lucky, you'll end up with a group of several specialists who all specialize in certain areas or, you know, different games, so that you do get to jump around without, you know, having to do it yourself.
Yeah, if it rotates to, I mean, if they do what we do, where they have a rotating game master system, after you finish your D&D campaign, then it switches to World of Darkness. Yeah, that would be ideal.
Right.
But for new players, be a little bit of a specialist at first, and then come over to the dabbler side.
Right. Come over to the dark side. Yeah.
Gosh. There can be only two systems. Yeah. Actually, that doesn't work, eh?
Nope.
Because I guess the dark side are specialists.
Hmm.
Oh. Yeah, that doesn't work. No, it doesn't work. Nope. Don't even try it.
Nope. Yeah. All right, fine.
All right, well, that ends our episode on generalist versus specialist. So just two basic approaches to role-playing. Obviously, both are fine approaches, but we've just established that one's a little bit better than the other one.
Right.
Just edged it out.
Yep. And if you disagree with us, well, then you can, you know, let us know in one of the myriad of ways Chris will dictate to you shortly. Take it away, Chris.
All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, outofredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idleredhands.com/forums and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Drive-through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-through RPG. The one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.